WDIY Lehigh Valley Public Radio presents Lehigh Valley Discourse. Provocative, informative, and newsworthy, Lehigh Valley Discourse brings you the people and the issues that move and shape our region here on WDIY.
Good evening on this Thanksgiving, and welcome to Lehigh Valley Discourse here on WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org. I'm John Pierce, your host. Our engineer this evening is James Johnson. Thank you, James. And my guest this evening is one of the prominent attorneys in the Lehigh Valley, Malcolm Gross, is going to talk about two different topics from history. Malcolm graduated Muhlenberg College in 1962, cum laude, and then he earned his law degree from Villanova University School of Law in 1965. Now, many of you know his name or maybe have met him because Malcolm has very deep roots here in the Lehigh Valley. In fact, I'm holding in my hand a book that he wrote called Two Mayors and a Lawyer, The Gross Family in Allentown History. So this is Malcolm's father and grandfather, not necessarily in that order, who were prominent in the Lehigh Valley before Mal came along. So Malcolm, you have a deep interest in history, and that's what we're going to talk about today, history rather than law. What was your undergraduate major at Muhlenberg?
History.
It was.
Oh, yeah. I seriously considered going into teaching of history and was talked out of it by one of my advisors and told to go to law school.
Oh.
I don't regret the decision, but I stayed involved, got my hand in with historical issues and lectures and so forth.
Right, which you love, obviously.
Yes.
That's funny because as I was thinking about this interview, I was thinking I could have said to you, you could have been a professor of history. And indeed, you could have, and almost did, but you've had such a successful law career that you've done well. So, two topics this evening. The first one is Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, and in the second half hour is General Trexler, who is one of the most famous people in the Lehigh Valley throughout its history. So, first of all, we're going to go to Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. And Mal, I think you're going to disabuse us of some myths about the address.
Sure. The address came up rather quickly, sadly in a way, because the enormous Battle of Gettysburg, a three-day battle, was fought in the summer of 1863 and ended on July 3rd. And then following that, sad to say, there were about 20,000 dead bodies or horribly wounded and maimed bodies laying all over the fields in Gettysburg. Plus, and many people forget this, thousands upon thousands of horses all rotting in the summer heat. You couldn't really fight a battle at that time without a lot of horses because there wasn't any way to move cannons or food or ammunition or anything else. And the poor beasts were killed just the way the men were during the battle. It was a very, very tough fight, went down to the very end, and of course at Pickett's charge, when Pickett was repulsed at the Bloody Angle on the third day, Meade had defeated Lee. But after that, the question for the state and the town was, what do we do now? Because the battlefield was just littered with corpses.
You're right. I don't think about the fact that so many horses had to die.
Yeah. The whole thing was a terrible slaughter. And, of course, they didn't have modern sanitary arrangements. Governor Curtin asked a man named Wills, who was the most prominent person in Gettysburg, to take charge of the situation. And he began organizing burial parties. But he also came up with the idea of turning the Gettysburg battlefield into a large national cemetery, which was a new concept at that time. There are only very few cemeteries, national cemeteries in the country. Most cemeteries were what you see the little churchyard cemeteries, but they were gradually, sad to say, going out of fashion. And the National Cemetery Movement, I think there were about maybe were two other cemeteries that had been started in the Midwest. The idea was to put them on the edge of a town and to be beautiful and a place where people could come and meditate and think about life and death. But they were intended to be the equivalent of a beautiful park. And he had that idea for Gettysburg. Of course, once you do that, you've got to have a dedication. The 19th century was very big into the ceremonial dedications. And so he began trying to organize a dedication event. And that in itself was somewhat structured. There were things you did at these dedications that were de rigueur. And the first thing you needed was a major speaker. That was not Lincoln. That was a man named Edward Everett, who was the former governor of Massachusetts, former Secretary of State, former United States Senator. And he wrote to Everett and asked him if he would give the dedicatory address. They originally had planned it for early November, but Everett got back to him and said he would do it, but that he needed a couple more weeks to prepare his material, particularly to read up on the battle. So then they set the date for the address in late November. And by the way, that was taking a risk I've often thought about, because Pennsylvania in late November is not usually a very good weather risk, but they set it for them. And if you look at a map, And look, if you ever want to look in Wikipedia at railroad maps, just look at railroads in the United States in 1850 and then 1860. And I think you'll be amazed at the honeycomb of railroads that had sprung up in those 10 years, and even more were being built during the war, almost all in the north. And then take a look at a map and realize, sad to say, that Gettysburg, and probably that's why the battle was there, is right in the middle of the whole thing. So it was very, very convenient, meaning for a dedicatory event, people could get there rather easily by railroad train. And additionally, of course, the telegraph had been laid down from, I think, about the 1830s. And so the communication was very easy. In addition to a dedication speaker, you needed a minister to give an invocation. It couldn't be a Catholic priest or a rabbi. It had to be a minister.
Absolutely.
And then you needed a dedication. You needed somebody to write a poem or a special dedicatory song. You needed a parade with music. And then, of course, you needed a benediction. And one last thing you needed was a final speaker, somebody to just say a few words to close the event. So Wells wrote to Everett. Then he thought, well, perhaps we could get President Lincoln. Remember, it was very convenient to Washington. It was just a overnight train ride. And he wrote to Lincoln and said, I've always thought this phrase was it meant to be a signal that we don't want you to say much, or was it meant to be a signal? Was it trying to lure Lincoln into what looked like an easy speech? But he did say, could you say a few words? And Lincoln
stuck to that.
Yes, he did. He responded with that. That's exactly right. And that, they knew they'd be able, there was going to be a crowd of about 15,000 people, very large crowd for that time. And the next thing that had happened was the northern papers, there, which were, really getting important at that time, they could get their reporters there. Because they could hop on the same trains from New York, Washington, Philadelphia, and points west and get there to cover the event. So it was going to be widely publicized. Lincoln agreed immediately. And Lincoln said, now this is the political side, and I'm sure also Lincoln was terribly moved by the fact that this great victory, a really important Union victory, turned the tide in the war after 3 years of Union defeats. But he sensed that there was a political opportunity here too, because 1864 was only a year away, and there was an election coming up, and the presidents were, and maybe this was a good thing, were not expected to campaign. In fact, it was, when I said not expected, it wasn't considered appropriate for them. It was considered undignified for them to campaign. So Lincoln was stuck in Washington. He also was running the war. Literally, the president, he had two secretaries and ran the whole war. So he didn't really have a political opportunity to campaign. But Lincoln knew immediately that this event was going to be widely covered, and he immediately got back and said, yes, I'll do it, and prepared to come to Gettysburg. You ask about some of the myths about this address. I think the one that everybody loves to tell was that he wrote the speech on the back of an envelope on the train coming over. That's right. Not true. Lincoln was a brilliant lawyer, and he was famous for his closing speeches in courtrooms, and he translated that into being a terrific political speaker. But he would work and rework his speeches practically until he got up on the stage. So he started working on this right away.
Now, Mal, the speech itself, the Gettysburg Address, was given on November 19th.
Yes.
At the cemetery to dedicate this new cemetery?
Yes.
And how long before that date was Lincoln approached to make this speech?
He would have been approached several months before.
Okay.
But he had a lot of other things to do. But immediately sensed, as I said, that this was an opportunity because this was going to be covered by every major newspaper, and it was an opportunity to get on the front page of every newspaper. The other thing that is fascinating about it to me is you're going to read it, that's great. It's so short. And Lincoln was shrewd enough to see that Everett, who was speaking before him, was going to speak for 1.5 hours. Well, there's no way the press could get all of that on their front page. But they could get on their front page 3 minutes, just 3 or 4 inches of copy. So if you look at the papers from that time, Lincoln got front page coverage on every newspaper in the country because it fitted so easily.
He was the president, and it fit, as you said.
Yeah.
I didn't even think about that, the fact that the political side of it.
The political side is one of the things that really fascinates me because he also sensed and knew that the governors, the Republican governors of every eastern state would be there. And by eastern, I should say Midwestern, too. Because, again, you could get there easily by train. It was a tremendously important event. So they were all going to hop a train and come to Gettysburg. So Lincoln would have a chance that he wouldn't have had otherwise to speak to them. He couldn't make a direct appeal. He took with him, the president had only two secretaries. That was it. That was the entire executive branch. He took them with him, and we got there the night before, and he then sent them out to every one of the bed and breakfasts and hotels and so forth, to promote Lincoln's candidacy because he couldn't. They all got drunk. because every governor was having a party. But it was another important, really important connection he made because there wasn't any ability to have person-to-person contact. I'm just fascinated by the staging of this. When Lincoln got there the night before, there was, of course, a crowd at the train station. And they all began calling out, naturally, speech, speech. Lincoln wouldn't come out and speak. He didn't want to have disjointed newspaper story using up the space he was going to get for his speech. So there was this air of mystery about what he was going to say.
Mal, we're going to stop you right there for just a minute because we need to take a break here.
All right.
On Lehigh Valley Discourse for this Thanksgiving. All of us here at WDIY are wishing you all a very happy Thanksgiving Day. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment.
Do you have a car that you're trading in? How about an old truck or boat that's taking up space? Let WDIY help you get rid of unwanted vehicles and turn them into financial support for the station. It's a simple and easy process. We handle all the towing, title, and transfer, and it may be tax deductible. Turn your vehicle into the programs you love. To learn more, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7.
Welcome back to Lehigh Valley Discourse here on Thanksgiving evening. I'm John Pierce, your host, our engineer, James Johnson, and our guest is Malcolm Gross, who is a prominent lawyer in the Lehigh Valley and just loves history. So we are talking about Lincoln's Gettysburg Address at this time. This battle took place in July of 1863.
July 1, 2, and 3.
Correct. And then the Lincoln's Gettysburg Address took place in November of that year.
Yes. Well, I think when I left off, we had Lincoln at the train station. Now, he did not go to his hotel. Instead, he went to the hotel where his Secretary of State, William Seward, was staying. Lincoln had beaten Seward for the presidential nomination on the Republican Party and then had named him Secretary of State. And he had tremendous respect for Seward. So, although we don't know, the supposition is that they worked on his speech and the staging of it even further. And we know one thing that was changed. At Seward's suggestion, the words "under God" when Lincoln in the last paragraph were inserted. We have six copies of the speech. There weren't even mimeograph machines, let alone copy machines, so it had to be hand copied. And one of those was given to Seward. One of them went to Edward Everett. Nicolay and his other assistant each got a copy. One copy has been lost and so forth. But the words "under God" were inserted into the speech. Now, and when you read it, you will undoubtedly read them. And that's what appeared. However, he probably didn't use the words because newspaper reporters at that time were trained to be more than reporters. They were the precursor of the modern court reporter. They took shorthand, and then they would transcribe their notes and turn it into a news story. There were four reporters there from major newspapers. None of them, in their transcription, have the words "under God." Yet they are there in the copy. So it's interesting as to what happened there. My uninformed theory is that Lincoln just accidentally skipped the words. He spent so much time rehearsing the speech without them that even though he was reading it, he just skipped the words.
Interesting. Mal, do you remember back in the 1950s when the words "under God" were added to the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag?
I was in grade school, yes.
Yes.
I remember well.
So was I. And so I just wonder if that could be a throwback to the Gettysburg Address. I guess we'll never know.
We don't know. I know that President Eisenhower was a big promoter of that, and it was part of the anti-communist movement that they added it, thinking rightly that there was a lot of speechifying about godless communism.
Yes.
So that's why they added it to the address itself. So that's pretty much what happened that evening. The next day, they had this parade, which we don't know where Lincoln gave the talk. We know it was at Gettysburg. There's supposition of a couple of spots, but there's nothing left of wherever the stage was that he talked from, and so we are not aware of the exact spot of the speech. We know that now this again is why I say he was such a brilliant lawyer as well as brilliant speaker, because remember Everett had spoken for an hour and a half. People were probably a little restless and tired. We have a couple of photographs where we think we have a Lincoln in the picture. You can see a man in a stovepipe high hat who most scholars think is Lincoln, but it was so quick Lincoln's Gettysburg Address that the photographers really weren't able to get a really good shot of it. However, the parade ends. Now it's the turn of the woman reading her poem and then the speech by Everett. Now then comes Lincoln, and just imagine the staging of this. Now, first of all, he's an enormous man, 6'6", dominating presence, very high voice, which was unusual, but it actually worked well for him. He'd made it work well as a speaker because people had to be very quiet. They didn't have somebody yelling at them through a bullhorn. And so they had to really listen to what he was saying. So he strodes on the stage. He's got papers in his hand, which, of course, were the speech. But he puts those papers on the podium and then steps away from the podium. Now, everybody is thinking, what are those papers he has? Why did he bring that out? Why did he put them down? Because you didn't typically do that. He then starts off, as you will, and the famous words, 47 years ago.
47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. Abraham Lincoln, November 19, 1863.
Now, no one talked that way then. That was not the way. It was way, way arcane in terms of the speech, of the common talk at that time. But it was biblical. Lincoln was a tremendous lover of the Bible, read it all the time. He read Blackstone's Law Commentaries, and the Bible just read them. That's how he really taught himself to read, taught himself to express himself. But he started that way, and then after having said those words, he stepped back to the podium and now picked up the speech and read the rest of it, which again was not done. Usually the orators, they might have had notes, but they just orated. He read it, and that made a statement, this is really important. The president is reading this address. And then, of course, he worked his way through it, and there's all kinds of arguments about whether it was applause or not, but the best accounts I've seen say there was a smattering of applause, as there had been for Everett's speech. This was not an event that people stood up and cheered about. It was a solemn event, but he did read it, and then he came back and sat down. Now, he did not say, I failed. It was a terrible, there were stories that he...
That's another myth.
He didn't say that. He sat down. Now, Everett did say to him at that point, if I could have said what you said, even in 1 hour, I would have been happy. You know, Everett was the greatest speaker of his time. So, Everett really asked for a copy. That's why there are 6 copies. And you don't usually ask for a copy of something you're going to throw away.
Right.
So that was the day, that was the speech, and then as he had expected, and I'm sure Abe did, every newspaper in the country carried his, you know, wonderful words right in the center of his front page.
It's a great example of less is more.
Right? Yep, exactly.
Especially in contrast to the hour and a half speech that these people had to sit through.
Yep, that's all correct. And that Lincoln turned every disadvantage into an advantage, turned his height into an advantage, turned the fact that he didn't have much time to speak into an advantage, turned his awkward frame. He made fun of his looks, but people liked his looks. If you look at the photographs of him, he was somebody who people liked to look at that face, and he took advantage of every one of them. He also was shrewd enough to recognize that the photograph was the precursor of television. Everywhere he went to make a speech, all of his different campaign stops, the first thing he would do was go to the local photography shop. The photography was very new, but he would go there and get his picture taken, knowing that the photographer would put that picture in the front window of his shop. And people next week or so would stop and look at, who is, oh, that's Lincoln. He's speaking at the Cooper Union or whatever he was going to be doing, but he always got his picture taken.
More strategy by the president.
Yeah, always very clever, but without being in your face up front shouting at you.
Yes. I did find, Mal, that now regarded as one of the great speeches of history, the address was initially greeted with criticism by many newspapers. The Democratic Chicago Times called the address a perversion of history. And so it was not greeted. And as happens with many things in life, great musical compositions, in this case, a great speech, one of our greatest. Were you obliged to learn it by heart when you were in school?
Sure we were.
Those are the good old days.
Yeah. And I can say the Chicago Times was a Democratic paper. So that, you know, the newspapers in those days were all either Republican or Democratic, and each town had both, and neither could say anything nice about the other. So,
right.
Yeah, the Democratic press definitely criticized his speech, mainly because they didn't like Lincoln, period.
But he was from Illinois. What's wrong with this picture? Mal, it's time for us to take another break.
Okay.
And we have come to the end of talking about the Gettysburg Address for this evening. Malcolm Gross is staying with us now, and he's going to speak about General Harry C. Trexler in just a moment. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Celtic Fair, a celebration of Celtic music and culture, from its roots in Ireland, Scotland, Wales, Brittany, and Galicia, to its branches in Australia, Cape Breton, Canada, Chicago, New York, Philadelphia, and the Lehigh Valley. Music, interviews, and a weekly culture calendar, every Thursday from 7 to 9, here on WDIY.
Connect with WDIY with our new app. Download for free from the Apple or Google Store and enjoy the great music, news, and programs you love on the go. The easy-to-use app is where you can listen to WDIY live or your favorite music shows on demand with our two-week archive feature. Download and share the WDIY app with your friends and family and introduce them to many choices, real voices.
Welcome back to Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm John Pierce, your host, our engineer, James Johnson. We both wish you a very happy Thanksgiving. Hope that you can spend it with family and friends, even in this frantic 2020 in which we are living. My guest this evening, Malcolm Gross, is to be congratulated for the Time Achievement Award from the Legal Intelligencer, the nation's oldest legal newspaper. Now, here's what I found out, Mal, that when you had been nominated and you received a letter informing you of your win, I was quite shocked and pleased because I didn't know I was even on their radar. That this was the only award recipient from outside the Philadelphia area. What an honor.
Yes, it was a great honor, and they had a wonderful dinner, and many of the leading lights of the Philadelphia bar and bench were there. So it was a tremendous honor.
What a great thing. And you received the award for your work surrounding the First Amendment.
Yes.
And how it pertains to the press.
Yes, exactly. I presented the Morning Call for many years, and I represented a number of other papers, Sunbury Daily Item for one, and others around the state. And it was and still is very exciting work, and you really feel as though you're on the side of the angels, so to speak, in trying to shed light on what's going on in the country.
Really? And that famous quotation from Thomas Jefferson, if I had to choose between a free press and the government, it would be the free press.
Right? Yes. Well, I would say the same thing.
So Malcolm Gross is a history buff and was history major as an undergraduate at Muhlenberg College. We were just talking a minute ago about the Gettysburg Address, and now we're going to move to closer to home, although not very many miles up the road here to the Lehigh Valley, and talk about Harry C. Trexler, one of the most prominent names in Lehigh Valley history. He was born in 1854, so that means he was 9 years old when the Gettysburg Address was delivered.
Yes.
Interesting. And he died in 1933. He and his wife did not have children. He was an industrialist, a businessman, major philanthropist, interested in agriculture, horsemanship, nature, book collecting. And Malcolm Gross is going to tell us a little bit about General Trexler. By the way, Mal, where did he get the title General?
He never fired a shot in anger. He was a general in the National Guard. So the only active service that he saw was when Woodrow Wilson sent the American troops to the border because Pancho Villa was acting up down in Mexico. So he was down there. Other than that, he worked his way. I actually have a pin of him for Romper Day, which was an event he created in Allentown, and it shows a picture of him on it, and it calls him as Colonel Trexler because he wasn't named a general in the National Guard until relatively late in his military career.
Okay, and Romper Day was for children.
Yes, sir. It was. We still have it. All the Allentown playgrounds had what was called, this was all started by Trexler. It was a wonderful idea. If you think about what it was like in the terrific heat of summer in Allentown, nobody had any air conditioning, and most children's parents couldn't afford to take them anywhere cooler. What they did was set up a daily playground events in all the school playgrounds, and those kids went there every day. It gave them a place to go and play, and they had teachers there who showed them how to play games and so forth. That went on for the whole summer, and during that time, they would rehearse. Each playground was in a big parade on what was called Romper Day, and then the kids would do their whatever their event was, whether it was baton twirling or whatever. And the general was a great supporter of that and a proponent of that. So it was really a great thing for children.
Right. My children participated in that back in the 1970s.
Yeah, and we still have it. I just retired as a trustee of the Trexler Trust, and the trust with the general's fortune is one of the many things that it supports. It's a very good cause.
Yes. Tell us, Mal, about the Trexler Trust. It's very famous, very well known. One of the first things that I learned about when I arrived in the Lehigh Valley in 1970 was the fantastic park system in Allentown. And the guiding hand of that, I guess, was Harry Trexler.
Yes, it was. The general died with, as you said, no children. His widow only survived him by a few, very short number of
years. 1 year.
And he left. He left his entire fortune to a trust to be administered by five trustees appointed by the court. And I was very fortunate to be named one of them, not at the time of the general's death, but
right.
20 years ago. Just retired a couple months ago after 20 years as a trustee. The trust administers a fund of about $130 million and uses that and gives away that money in grants. And a large portion of it is by terms of the will given to the city of Allentown for the park system. You would not have this park system you have without those funds. The city could never afford it. The general and my grandfather, Malcolm W. Gross, who was mayor during his Drexler, my grandfather was mayor for 20 years of the time that Drexler was active. And they came up with this idea of acquiring all there are five streams that flow into and out of Allentown. And their idea was acquire the land along those streams because running water makes a park that much more attractive.
Absolutely.
And interesting and so forth. So they bought all, now they didn't probably realize it at the time, but it was also a terrific environmental decision because the city parks now have prevented overconstruction in those areas along those streams, which otherwise would have been built up.
Right.
Oh, so it worked in terrifically in two ways.
That's a great point. Now, there are five trustees for the Drexler Trust. Do they serve a lifetime term?
No, they don't. There's nothing in the will about that, as far as I remember. No, it's a 10-year term, and then you can be reappointed if you apply, and the judges think you're doing a good job. I was lucky enough to reapply and be given a second 10-year term.
So 20 years tops.
No, you could.
You could keep on. You could be an FDR on this thing.
You could do that if you wanted to, but I.
You obviously didn't want to.
And Father Dan Gamet was a trustee a couple years before me, and he also retired at the end of his second 10-year term. It takes a lot of time, and it's also time for get some new blood in there and get some new ideas. So I was thrilled to be a trustee for 20 years, but I did believe it was time that there was somebody new come in and Don Hart.
It's a great honor.
It was a tremendous honor, especially for a lawyer to be. It doesn't have to be a lawyer. He didn't indicate that in his will. It's a real honor for a lawyer to be selected by the court because it says some things about the lawyer.
Now, Mal, I've heard that the trust does not dip into the principal of the money left by General Drexler, but only
interest.
The interest. Is that correct?
Well, that's sort of true. That you're asking a complicated tax question. I'm not a tax lawyer.
Uh-oh.
the trust is required to spend, I believe, 5% of its yearly income. I should say revenue, really. Because, you know, in the modern stock market, you have to invest in all kinds of stocks, some of which are not income producing, but when you buy them, you've got to still give a percentage of that to the park system and other charities. About two-thirds of the fund is given off to other worthy Lehigh County charities. So we've given away about $100 million over the year, not just in my time, but over the time, to various local charities, and they need the money just like the city does. So it
right.
works well.
And it's published in the newspapers every year that these are the organizations that received how much
right.
money. It's very, very open.
You have to be a county charity, and you have to be a 501c3. Sometimes we get some kind of unusual requests or people who think they or their family are a charitable institution, but that's not very often. We've supported a lot of good causes.
Mal, it's time for us to take a break now.
Okay.
We're talking this evening with Malcolm Gross, and our topic right now, General Harry C. Trexler and the many different wonderful things that he's done for the Lehigh Valley, that he did in his lifetime, 1854 to 1933. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm John Pierce. We'll be back in just a moment.
Galactic Travels brings you hour-long soundscapes of electronic, ambient, and space music. A special focus for November, Tone Science on Din Records. That's Thursday night at 11, right here on WDIY Allentown, Lehigh Valley Public Radio, 88.1 FM and WDIY.org. Many choices, real voices.
Welcome back to Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm talking this evening with Malcolm Gross, and we're talking right now about General Harry C. Trexler. Malcolm was a trustee for the Trexler Trust, which is very well known in the Lehigh Valley for doing philanthropic work. Mal, tell us about some of the activities that Harry Trexler was involved in.
Well, Trexler was a true entrepreneur. You know, I have an uninformed theory about this. I believe he was of a generation I call the patriarchs. By that, I mean there were Charlie Schwab in Bethlehem would be another good example, and Asa Packer up in Jim Thorpe. Almost every town in the whole Pennsylvania area and probably outside of it had somebody akin to Harry Trexler. A dominated, always, they're not always men. Mary Scranton up in Scranton was not shy, but a dominated force who really pulled the town together. And I think that is because both transportation and communication just were so revolutionized in the century, in the decades after the Civil War. It seemed as though in every town, there was somebody people looked up to, maybe looking to their past as well, and said, this is kind of the father of our town. This is the person we look up to as a leader. And that was Harry Trexler. He started in the lumber business. He unfortunately clear-cut the Poconos. That's how they built a lot of Philadelphia and the cities down here. But after that, he became quite concerned about the environment, and of course he contributed to many causes. If you ever go to Hickory Run State Park, that was one of that's a huge chunk of land up in the Poconos with a lake and so forth. That was Trexler. He owned that. That was a place where he and his friends went to vacation, and it ended up owned by the state of Pennsylvania. The parks you've mentioned already. But he also controlled the newspaper. He controlled what was then Lehigh Cement, PPL, and the trolley company. And remember, this was the time, I'm talking about the period from maybe 1900 to 1930. For the most part, during that time, until Henry Ford came along, transportation was by electric trolley. And that was a tremendously important vehicle for growth of cities. People, including my grandfather on my mother's side, he used to buy land. He'd drive around where he saw trolley tracks going in. He'd buy the land right beyond it because he was sure people would build houses there, and he was right.
How about it?
So there were all these revolutionary changes taking place, and Trexler, being a visionary, saw them all and invested in them all and took leadership in all. So that was a major part about him. He certainly was not somebody who was a loudmouth. I have a lot of newspaper clippings, and you look back and trek through, the newspaper always reported that the general was at the meeting, and then he would usually just make one cryptic remark, and everybody seemed to know what that meant, and the meeting would be adjourned. He people respected him, respected his force of personality. His brother, Frank Trexler, put on the Superior Court, and he became president judge of that court, even though my grandfather was a Democrat and Harry was a Republican. They were secret allies. I say secret. Democrats and Republicans didn't mix at that time, but they were allies in getting the park system going. Trexler West Park in Allentown was Allentown's first park. That was about 1910. And Trexler lived near that and wanted to save it. And he's the one who led the fight to do that. Most cities didn't have park systems. And then he, one by one, acquired the land, as I said earlier. And my grandfather, with his silent support, gradually enlarged on the parks. And then even after, right after Trexler died, he brought the WPA in over terrific objections, and they're the ones that put up all the beautiful stonework that has preserved our parks. So all of that was the general. Nobody ever called. And he also had large orchards, huge Trexler orchards, and the what we used to call a game preserve, which is now the Lehigh Valley Environmental Preserve. And Lehigh County is the only county without a state park. And the general bought all the farms on the hillsides up there where the game preserve is, and then turned it into a game preserve and, again, a park. And now the county has, with Trexler Trust support, has renovated it and turned it into a beautiful site, huge site of land where you can hike or walk or fish in the stream or bicycle. It's really, anybody who hasn't been up there should. It's free.
Great. You used the word the vision of Harry Trexler. I guess that it all comes down to that. He was one of the five founding directors of PPNL back in the day.
She was.
And it turned into PPL afterward. Did you ever figure out why they took out the and?
Oh, you'd have to talk to the PR people about that.
Right.
But, you know, he did do, you know, that building, for I don't know if it's still true, but they used to say it's the tallest building outside of Philadelphia.
Oh.
And there was a lot of, at the time, PPL was under, there was discussion that it should go up in Hazleton. The general is the one who insisted it be built at 9th and Hamilton, and he then promptly moved his office there. Now, it was a massive office, but that put a stake in the ground that, hey, this city is worth something, and the rest of Allentown grew, you know, the downtown grew up around that building.
Well, that building is our one skyscraper in Allentown, huh? 22 stories.
Yeah.
Yes. Not so impressive by Manhattan standards, but it is ours.
Well, I think it's a mod. It was used as a, I may have this wrong. I say things and then later on. I think it's a model for the Empire State Building.
Oh.
I think the architect who designed it, it was meant to see whether it would work for the Empire, and then they built the Empire State Building after it. It's a beautiful building if you look at it. Very Art Deco.
Yes, Art Deco is the best. There's a list of 27 leading entrepreneurs in the USA. General Trexler is on that list, along with people like George Eastman, Henry Ford, Harvey Firestone.
Yes.
What heady company?
Yes. He was killed in an accident coming back from New York City because he was a very prominent person. A board of directors meeting, and he attended the meeting, and a friend who was a fellow director said, "Why don't you stay here for the night?" Because the meeting had gone slightly late. He said, "No, Mary Trexler, she will miss me not being home for dinner." And so he came home, and he had a chauffeur, of course, and they say he used to sit in the back seat with his cane pounding on the floor faster. Well, came to that dead man's curve in Easton, a small truck had broken down, and the driver of the truck was trying to get it off the road but hadn't succeeded, of course, and plowed right, Trexler's limousine plowed right into it. They rushed him to, I think, Sacred Heart Hospital. He got out of the He got out of the ambulance and walked into the hospital, but he only survived for a couple of days because he had a punctured lung. He was bleeding internally, and they didn't know it. But he was well in the years, but he was a force right up to the end.
Yes, indeed. And when I think about this Trexler Trust and the money that has been flowing since, do you imagine that began pretty close to the time of his death?
Oh, yes, because his wife was named, they had no children, and she was named one of the trustees. There were bequests, the will is public, there were bequests for, I think, his brother and so forth, which would have been looked at as significant, but it was most of his estate went into that trust, which the trustees have carefully nurtured through the years.
That's
I'd say it's worth about $130 million today and throws off quite a bit that goes to local charities.
Right, and what blows me away is that we're almost at the point of saying that was 100 years ago that he died.
Yes.
Yeah. Getting close to that.
Yeah, when I was a trustee, we did a celebration of his, I think it was his 100th birthday. It was one of his birthdays.
Okay.
He was, you know, I've been in this town all my life, and there were, when I was young, I was young once, there were a lot of old-timers who remember him. They loved to tell you stories about they knew the general, and the general had said this to them or done that.
Right.
He was very quietly kind to young people. He put, and we don't even know all who they were, but he put a number of them through college or the seminary or something of that type without any publicity about it whatsoever. He would just hear about them, and then he would pay their tuition.
They sort of became his children, even though he didn't have any of his own.
That's probably exactly right.
Right.
And that's why, you know, he and his wife love Romper Day, because it was all kids.
Right.
Oh, he also started, we had a flower show now, you know, the Philadelphia Flower Show. We had that magnificent flower show every year out in Trexler Park, which Trexler Park is another beautiful park we have.
Yes, indeed. And in fact, that was part of his game preserve, wasn't it?
No, that was, the Trexler Park is right on the edge of Allentown. That was his home away from home. There's a spring house there.
Yes.
Mary, he built a home there, but if you're ever out there and go up to where the general statue is, he had plans for a huge mansion out there, but Mary wouldn't move. She didn't want to be away from her friends. He lived right next to Christ Lutheran Church on Hamilton Street. What is that, about 13th?
Right. That house still stands.
Yeah, I believe it's now a funeral home.
Okay.
Beautiful home, but it wasn't a mansion. It was just a nice, comfortable. Again, and this I think is a lesson to us, which we haven't learned, he wasn't ostentatiously wealthy. I mean, he was tremendously wealthy, but he didn't live like he was tremendously wealthy. He was a man who spoke to everybody in town, see the pictures of him. You know, he wore nice clothes. He and Mary took some occasional trips, but he wasn't ostentatious about his wealth, and there's a message there, I think.
Yes, absolutely.
And then look at the good he did with it, you know, late during life and then after life. He had a really positive effect on the community for his whole life and after. And now here we are getting, 80 years or more from his death, and we're still being influenced by it. And, you know, the thing about him is, He's probably the one name that everybody knows. They don't know much about him, but everybody, General Trexler, it still makes an impression on them.
Yes.
And I think it's wonderful.
Your law firm is a very big contributor to the Lehigh County Historical Society.
Yes.
And in the lobby of that building, there are tremendously big portraits of General Trexler and his wife, Mary.
Yes.
Very well done.
Yeah. He's worth remembering.
So we want to give a shout out to Joe Guerrera and Jill Youngkin, who run the Lehigh County Historical Society, the museum that before the pandemic hit would have speeches talks by various experts, not necessarily just Lehigh Valley, but from around the country on various topics. And you have been a speaker at in that series as well.
Yes, they do a terrific, Joe and Jill do a terrific job in all regards. A beautiful museum, very well run. And they, once we can get through this pandemic, they have a program almost every Saturday. And usually it's by nationally famous historians or other significant people. They honor General Hayes, or the first woman general.
Yes.
And they've really, really made that into something very special, and it's worth a visit. You can visit it even though we have a pandemic, but you can still go down there and visit if you're looking for something interesting to do.
Yeah, that's a good message to send out to everybody. Call ahead these different places that you were used to going to before, and
right now
we don't know what the situation is exactly.
Yeah, you should call ahead, but I'd say 99% of the time they will let you in and probably even give you a tour. And the other thing you definitely should look at is Trout Hall, the founder's home, which sits right next to the museum. That's a beautiful mansion and beautifully furnished with Revolutionary War-style furniture, and it's really worth seeing.
Mal, I don't know if Trout Hall is open on a regular basis, or do people make an appointment?
Yeah, you have to call for an appointment because, it's a very old building. The furniture is very delicate, but they'll accommodate you if you just give them a call and go for a convenient time.
That's the original home of Muhlenberg College.
In the
days when they had three or four professors and a dozen or two dozen students.
Yeah, well, that's exactly correct. 1848, I think it started.
Yes.
And they moved out to the present location in about 1920,
right.
I think.
In fact, movements in Allentown have generally been from east to west.
That's an interesting point.
The library, public library, the First Presbyterian Church that I know about, moving from where the Allentown Art Museum is now.
Yes.
Out to Cedar Crest Boulevard. And you were talking about Trexler Park being sort of out in the boonies in the old days. That's Cedar Crest Boulevard. That's heavily traveled now, one of our main thoroughfares.
It is. So. And the general just had what they called a lodge on it. He and his friends would go there and probably have a keg of beer and fish the stream and relax. It was cool. It's cool there, even in warm weather. And again, as I say, the same way with Hickory Run, he was not an ostentatious man. He was a wealthy man, the wealthiest man in the area, powerful man but he used his power appropriately, and he never flaunted his wealth.
And let's give a shout out to Easton, because General Trexler was born in Easton.
Yes.
And then the family moved to Allentown.
Yep, Trexler Lumber. That was their first company.
Trexler Lumber. Think of all the different entities in the Lehigh Valley that are named Trexler.
Yep, that's right.
Middle school.
Yep.
Libraries.
Yep.
What a legacy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a very admirable person and somebody who we should emulate if only we could.
Malcolm Gross has been my guest this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse. Mal, thanks so much for enlightening us on two different topics. The first one was the Gettysburg Address, and the second one, General Harry Trexler of Lehigh Valley fame.
Thank you, John. It's always a pleasure.
We wish all of you a very happy end of your Thanksgiving Day. I'm John Pierce, along with my colleague James Johnson, working the board for us this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse. Thanks so much for tuning in. Until we meet again, remember to be gentle with your neighbor.